Tom, listen. One of us will walk up to this guy Nicholson's house tomorrow, after it's full daylight. It's Nickerson. And I don't think that's a very smart idea, especially since Swami McCourt sees him kneeling inside his living room window with a fully automatic rifle he's been saving for the end of the world, which seems to have rolled around. I'll do it, Clay said. And I won't do it if we hear any gunshots from the Nickerson place tonight or tomorrow morning. I certainly won't do it if I see any bodies on the guy's lawn, with or without gunshot wounds. I watched all those old Twilight Zone episodes, too. The ones where civilization turns out to be nothing more than a thin layer of shellac. If that, Tom said gloomily, Idi Amin, Pol Pot, the prosecution rests. I'll go with my hands raised, ring the doorbell. If someone answers, I'll say I just want to talk. What's the worst that can happen? He tells me to get lost.
No. The worst that can happen is he can shoot you dead on his fucking welcome mat and leave me with a motherless teenage girl,
Tom said sharply.
Smart off about old Twilight Zone episodes all you want. Just don't forget those people you saw today, fighting outside the T station in Boston.
That was... I don't know what it was, but those people were clinically insane. You can't doubt that, Tom.
What about Bible-thumping Bertha? And the two men fighting over the keg, were they insane?
No, of course they hadn't been. But if there was a gun in that house across the street, he still wanted it. And if there was more than one, he wanted Tom and Alice each to have one, too. I'm thinking about going north over 100 miles, Clay said. We might be able to boost a car and drive some of it, but we might have to walk the whole way. Do you want to go with just knives for protection? I'm asking you as one serious man to another, because some of the people we run into are going to have guns. I mean, you know that.
Yes, Tom said.
He ran his hands through his neatly trimmed hair, giving it a comic ruffle.
And I know that Arnie and Beth are probably not home. They were gadget nuts as well as gun nuts. He was always gabbing on his cell phone when he went by in that big Dodge Ram Detroit Phallus of his.
See, there you go.
Tom sighed. All right. Depending on how things look in the morning, okay?
Okay. Clay picked up his sandwich again. He felt a little more like eating now.
Where did they go? Tom asked. The ones you call the phone crazies. Where did they go?
I don't know.
I'll tell you what I think, Tom said. I think they crawled into the houses and the buildings around sundown and died.
Clay looked at him doubtfully.
Look at it reasonably and you'll see I'm right, Tom said. This was almost certainly some sort of terrorist act. Would you agree?
That seems the most likely explanation. Although I'll be damned if I know how any signal, no matter how subversive, could have been programmed to do what this one did.
Are you a scientist?
You know I'm not. I'm an artist.
So when the government tells you they can guide computerized smart bombs through bunker doors in the floor of the desert from aircraft carriers that are maybe 2,000 miles away, all you can do is look at the photos and accept that the technology exists.
Would Tom Clancy lie to me? Clay asked, unsmiling.
And if that technology exists, why not accept this one, at least on a provisional basis?
Okay, spell it out. Small words, please.
At about 3 o'clock this afternoon, some terrorist organization, maybe even a tin pot government, generated some sort of signal, or pulse. For now we have to assume that this signal was carried by every cell phone operating in the entire world. We'll hope that wasn't the case, but for now I think we have to assume the worst.
Is it over?
I don't know, Tom said. Do you want to pick up a cell phone and find out?
Touchy, Clay said. That's how my little boy says touché. And please God, how he's still saying it.
But if this group could transmit a signal that would send everyone hearing it insane, Tom said, isn't it possible that the signal could also contain a directive for those receiving it to kill themselves 5 hours later? Or perhaps to simply go to sleep and stop breathing?
I would say that's impossible.
I would have said a madman coming at me with a knife across from the Four Seasons Hotel was impossible, Tom said. Or Boston burning flat while the city's entire population, that part of it lucky enough not to have cell phones, that is, left by the Mystic and the Zakim.
He leaned forward, looking at Clay intently. He wants to believe this, Clay thought. Don't waste a lot of time trying to talk him out of it, because he really, really wants to.
In a way, this is no different from the bioterrorism the government was so afraid of after 9/11, he said. By using cell phones, which have become the dominant form of communication in our daily lives, you simultaneously turn the populace into your own conscript army. An army that's literally afraid of nothing, because it's insane. And you break down the infrastructure. Where's the National Guard tonight?
Iraq, Clay ventured. Louisiana? It wasn't much of a joke, and Tom didn't smile.
It's nowhere. How do you use a homeland force that now depends almost entirely on the cellular network to even mobilize? As for airplanes, the last one I've seen flying was the little one that crashed on the corner of Charles and Beacon.
He paused, then went on, looking straight across the table into Clay's eyes.
All this they did, whoever they is. They looked at us from wherever it is they live and worship their gods, and what did they see?
Clay shook his head, fascinated by Tom's eyes shining behind his spectacles. They were almost the eyes of a visionary.
They saw we had built the Tower of Babel all over again, and on nothing but electronic cobwebs. And in a space of seconds, they brushed those cobwebs aside, and our tower fell. All this they did, and you think they could not have encoded a signal telling the affected ones to simply fall asleep and stop breathing 5 hours later? What's that trick compared to the first one? Not much, I'd say.
Clay said, I'd say it's time we got some sleep. For a moment, Tom remained as he was, hunched across the table a little, looking at Clay as if unable to understand what Clay had said. Then he laughed.
Yeah, he said.
Yeah, you've got a point. I get wound up. Sorry.
Not at all, Clay said. I hope you're right about the crazies being dead.
He paused, then said, I mean, unless my boy, Johnny G. He couldn't finish. Partly, or maybe mostly because if Johnny had tried to use his phone this afternoon and had gotten the same call as Pixie Light and Power Suit Woman, Clay wasn't sure he wanted his son to still be alive. Tom reached across the table to him, and Clay took the other man's delicate, long-fingered hand in both of his. He saw this happening as if he were outside his body, and when he spoke, he didn't seem to be the one speaking, although he could feel his mouth moving and the tears that had begun to fall from his eyes.
I'm so scared for him, his mouth was saying. I'm scared for both of them, but mostly for my kid.
It'll be all right, Tom said, and Clay knew he meant well, but the words struck terror into his heart just the same. Because it was just one of those things you said when there was really nothing else. Like, you'll get over it. Or, he's in a better place.
Chapter 11 Alice's shrieks woke Clay from a confused but not unpleasant dream of being in the bingo tent at the Akron State Fair. In the dream he was 6 again, maybe even younger, but surely no older. And crouched beneath the long table where his mother was seated, looking at a forest of lady legs and smelling sweet sawdust while the caller intoned,
B12, players, B12. It's the sunshine vitamin.
There was one moment when his subconscious mind tried to integrate the girl's cries into the dream by insisting he was hearing the Saturday noon whistle, but only a moment. Clay had let himself go to sleep on Tom's porch after an hour of watching, because he was convinced that nothing was going to happen out there, at least not tonight. But he must have been equally convinced that Alice wouldn't sleep through, because there was no real confusion once his mind identified her shrieks for what they were, no groping for where he was or what was going on. At one moment, he was a small boy crouching under a bingo table in Ohio. At the next, he was rolling off the comfortably long couch on Tom McCourt's enclosed front porch, with the comforter still wrapped around his lower legs. And somewhere in the house, Alice Maxwell, howling in a register almost high enough to burst crystal, articulated all the horror of the day just past, insisting with one scream after another that such things surely could not have happened and must be denied. Clay tried to rid his lower legs of the comforter, and at first it wouldn't let go. He found himself hopping toward the inside door and pulling at it in a kind of panic while he looked out at Salem Street, sure the lights would start going on up and down the block, even though he knew the power was out, sure that someone, maybe the gun-owning, gadget-loving Mr. Nickerson from up the street, would come out on his lawn and yell for someone to, for Christ's sake, shut that kid up.
"Don't make me come down there," Arnie Nickerson would yell. "Don't make me come down there and shoot her." Or her screams would draw the phone crazies, like moths to a bug light. Tom might think they were dead, but Clay believed it no more than he believed in Santa's workshop at the North Pole. But Salem Street, their block of it anyway, just west of the town center and below the part of Malden Tom had called Granada Highlands, remained dark and silent and without movement. Even the glow of the fire from Revere seemed to have diminished. Clay finally rid himself of the comforter and went inside and stood at the foot of the stairs, looking up into the blackness. Now he could hear Tom's voice, not the words, but the tone, low and calm and soothing. The girl's chilling shrieks began to be broken up by gasps for breath, then by sobs and inarticulate cries that became words. Clay caught one of them, nightmare. Tom's voice went on and on, telling lies in a reassuring drone. Everything was all right, she would see. Things would look better in the morning. Clay could picture them sitting side by side on the guest room bed, each dressed in a pair of pajamas with TM monograms on the breast pockets. He could have drawn them like that. The idea made him smile. When he was convinced she wasn't going to resume screaming, he went back to the porch, which was a bit chilly but not uncomfortable once he was wrapped up snugly in the comforter. He sat on the couch, surveying what he could see of the street. To the left, east of Tom's house, was a business district. He thought he could see the traffic light marking the entrance into the town square. The other way, which was the way they'd come, more houses. All of them still in this deep trench of night. "Where are you?" he murmured. "Some of you headed north or west and still in your right minds. But where did the rest of you go?" No answer from the street. Hell, maybe Tom was right. The cell phones had sent them a message to go crazy at 3 and drop dead at 8. It seemed too good to be true, but he remembered feeling the same way about recordable CDs. Silence from the street in front of him, silence from the house behind him. After a while, Clay leaned back on the couch and let his eyes close. He thought he might doze, but doubted he would actually go to sleep again. Eventually, however, he did, and this time there were no dreams. Once, shortly before first light, a mongrel dog came up Tom McCourt's front walk, looked in at him as he lay snoring in his cocoon of comforter, and then moved on. It was in no hurry. Pickings were rich in Malden that morning, and would be for some time to come. Chapter 12. "Clay, wake up." A hand shaking him. Clay opened his eyes and saw Tom, dressed in a pair of blue jeans and a gray work shirt, bending over him. The front porch was lit by strong, pale light. Clay glanced at his wristwatch as he swung his feet off the couch and saw it was 6:20. "You need to see this," Tom said. He looked pale, anxious, and grizzled on both sides of his mustache. The tail of his shirt was untucked on one side, and his hair was still standing up and back. Clay looked at Salem Street, saw a dog with something in its mouth trotting past a couple of dead cars half a block west, saw nothing else moving. He could smell a faint, smoky funk in the air, and supposed it was either Boston or Revere. Maybe both, but at least the wind had died. He turned his gaze to Tom. "Not out here," Tom said. He kept his voice low. "In the backyard. I saw when I went in the kitchen to make coffee, before I remembered coffee's out, at least for the time being. Maybe it's nothing, but... man, I don't like this." "Is Alice still sleeping?" Clay was groping under the comforter for his socks. "Yes, and that's good. Never mind your socks and shoes. This ain't dinner at the Ritz. Come on." He followed Tom, who was wearing a pair of comfortable-looking scuffs, down the hall to the kitchen. A half-finished glass of iced tea was standing on the counter. Tom said, "I can't get started without some caffeine in the morning, you know? So I poured myself a glass of that stuff. Help yourself, by the way, it's still nice and cold. And I pushed back the curtain over the sink to take a look out at my garden. No reason, just wanted to touch base with the outside world. And I saw... but look for yourself." Clay peered out through the window over the sink. There was a neat little brick patio behind the house with a gas grill on it.
Beyond the patio was Tom's yard, half grass and half garden. At the back was a high board fence with a gate in it. The gate was open. The bolt holding it closed must have been shot across because it now hung askew, looking to Clay like a broken wrist. It occurred to him that Tom could have made coffee on the gas grill, if not for the man sitting in his garden beside what had to be an ornamental wheelbarrow, eating the soft inside of a split pumpkin and spitting out the seeds. He was wearing a mechanic's coverall and a greasy cap with a faded letter B on it. Written in faded red script on the left breast of his coverall was George. Clay could hear the soft smooching sounds his face made every time he dove into the pumpkin.
"Fuck," Clay said in a low voice. "It's one of them."
"Yes, and where there's one, there'll be more."
"Did he break the gate to get in?"
"Of course he did," Tom said. "I didn't see him do it, but it was locked when I left yesterday, you can depend on that. I don't have the world's best relationship with Scottoni, the guy who lives on the other side. He has no use for fellas like me, as he's told me on several occasions."
He paused, then went on in a lower voice. He had been speaking quietly to begin with, and now Clay had to lean toward him to hear him.
"You know what's crazy? I know that guy. He works at Sonny's Texaco down in the center. It's the only gas station in town that still does repairs, or did. He replaced a radiator hose for me once. Told me about how he and his brother made a trip to Yankee Stadium last year, saw Kurt Schilling beat the big unit. Seemed like a nice enough guy. Now look at him, sitting in my garden eating a raw pumpkin."
"What's going on, you guys?" Alice asked from behind them. Tom turned around, looking dismayed.
"You don't want to see this," he said.
"That won't work," Clay said. "She's got to see it." He smiled at Alice, and it wasn't that hard to smile. There was no monogram on the pocket of the pajamas Tom had loaned her, but they were blue, just as he had imagined, and she looked most dreadfully cute in them, with her feet bare and the pants' legs rolled up to her shins and her hair tousled with sleep. In spite of her nightmares, she looked better rested than Tom. Clay was willing to bet she looked better rested than he did, too. "It's not a car wreck or anything," he said. "Just a guy eating a pumpkin in Tom's backyard." She stood between them, putting her hands on the lip of the sink and rising up on the balls of her feet to look out. Her arm brushed Clay's, and he could feel the sleep warmth still radiating from her skin. She looked for a long time, then turned to Tom.
"You said they all killed themselves," she said, and Clay couldn't tell if she was accusing or mock scolding.
"She probably doesn't know herself," he thought.
"I didn't say for sure," Tom replied, sounding lame. "You sounded pretty sure to me."
She looked out again. At least Clay thought she wasn't freaking out. In fact, he thought she looked remarkably composed, if a little chaplain-esque, in her slightly outsized pajamas.
Guys?
"What?" they said together.
"Look at the little wheelbarrow he's sitting next to. Look at the wheel."
Clay had already seen what she was talking about, the litter of pumpkin shell, pumpkin meat, and pumpkin seeds.
"He smashed the pumpkin on the wheel to break it open and get to what's inside," Alice said. "I guess he's one of them."
"Oh, he's one of them, all right," Clay said. George the mechanic was sitting in the garden with his legs apart, allowing Clay to see that since yesterday afternoon he'd forgotten all his mother had taught him about dropping trowel before you did number one.
"But he used that wheel as a tool. That doesn't seem so crazy to me."
"One of them was using a knife yesterday," Tom said, "and there was another guy jabbing a couple of car aerials."
"Yes, but this seems different somehow."
"More peaceful, you mean?" Tom glanced back at the intruder in his garden. "I wouldn't want to go out there and find out."
"No, not that. I don't mean peaceful. I don't know exactly how to explain it."
Clay thought he had an idea of what she was talking about. The aggression they had witnessed yesterday had been a blind, forward-rushing thing, an anything-that-comes-to-hand thing. Yes, there had been the businessman with the knife, and the muscular young guy jabbing the car aerials in the air as he ran, but there had also been the man in the park who'd torn off the dog's ear with his teeth. Pixie Light had also used her teeth. This seemed a lot different, and not just because it was about eating instead of killing. But like Alice, Clay couldn't put his finger on just how it was different. "Oh, God, two more," Alice said. Through the open back gate came a woman of about 40 in a dirty gray pantsuit and an elderly man dressed in jogging shorts and a T-shirt with Gray Power printed across the front. The woman in the pantsuit had been wearing a green blouse that now hung in tatters, revealing the cups of a pale green bra beneath. The elderly man was limping badly, throwing his elbows out in a kind of buck and wing with each step to keep his balance. His scrawny left leg was caked with dried blood, and that foot was missing its running shoe. The remains of an athletic sock, grimed with dirt and blood, flapped from his left ankle. The elderly man's longish white hair hung around his vacant face in a kind of cowl. The woman in the pantsuit was making a repetitive noise that sounded like, "Goom! Goom!" as she surveyed the yard and the garden. She looked at George the pumpkin eater as though he were of no account at all, then strode past him toward the remaining cucumbers. Here she knelt, snatched one from its vine, and began to munch. The old man in the Gray Power shirt marched to the edge of the garden, and then only stood there a while, like a robot that has finally run out of juice. He was wearing tiny gold glasses, reading glasses, Clay thought, that gleamed in the early light. He looked to Clay like someone who had once been very smart and was now very stupid. The three people in the kitchen crowded together, staring out the window, hardly breathing. The old man's gaze settled on George, who threw away a piece of pumpkin shell, examined the rest, and then plowed his face back in and resumed his breakfast. Far from behaving aggressively toward the newcomers, he seemed not to notice them at all. The old man limped forward, bent, and began to tug at a pumpkin the size of a soccer ball. He was less than 3 feet from George. Clay, remembering the pitched battle outside the tea station, held his breath and waited. He felt Alice grasp his arm. All the sleep warmth had departed her hand. "What's he going to do?" she asked in a low voice. Clay only shook his head. The old man tried to bite the pumpkin and only bumped his nose. It should have been funny, but wasn't. His glasses were knocked askew, and he pushed them back into place. It was a gesture so normal that for a brief moment, Clay felt all but positive that he was the one who was crazy. "Goom!" cried the woman in the tattered blouse, and threw away her half-eaten cucumber. She had spied a few late tomatoes and crawled toward them with her hair hanging in her face. The seat of her pants was badly soiled. The old man had spied the ornamental wheelbarrow. He took his pumpkin to it, then seemed to register George sitting there beside it. He looked at him, head cocked. George gestured with one orange-coated hand at the wheelbarrow, a gesture Clay had seen 1,000 times. "Be my guest," Tom murmured. "I'll be damned." The old man fell on his knees in the garden, a movement that obviously caused him considerable pain. He grimaced, raised his lined face to the brightening sky, and uttered a chuffing grunt. Then he lifted the pumpkin over the wheel. He studied the line of descent for several moments, elderly biceps trembling, and brought the pumpkin down, smashing it open. It fell in 2 meaty halves. What happened next happened fast. George dropped his own mostly eaten pumpkin in his lap, rocked forward, grabbed the old man's head in his big orange-stained hands, and twisted it. They heard the crack of the old man's breaking neck even through the glass. His long white hair flew. His small spectacles disappeared into what Clay thought were beets. His body spasmed once, then went limp. George dropped it. Alice began to scream, and Tom covered her mouth with his hand. Her eyes, bulging with terror, peered over the top of it. Outside in the garden, George picked up a fresh chunk of pumpkin and began calmly to eat. The woman in the shredded blouse looked around for a moment casually, then plucked another tomato and bit into it. Red juice ran from her chin and trickled down the dirty line of her throat. She and George sat there in Tom McCourt's backyard garden, eating vegetables. And for some reason, the name of one of his favorite paintings popped into Clay's mind. The Peaceable Kingdom. He didn't realize he'd spoken aloud until Tom looked at him bleakly and said, "Not anymore." Chapter 13. The three of them were still standing there at the kitchen window 5 minutes later, when an alarm began to bray at some distance. It sounded tired and hoarse, as though it would run down soon.
"Any idea what that might be?" Clay asked.
In the garden, George had abandoned the pumpkins and dug up a large potato. This had brought him closer to the woman, but he showed no interest in her, at least not yet.
"My best guess would be that the generator at the Safeway in the center just gave up," Tom said. "There's probably a battery-powered alarm in case that happens, because of all the perishables, but that's only a guess. For all I know, it's the First Malden Bank and
Look," Alice said. The woman stopped in the act of plucking another tomato, got up, and walked toward the east side of Tom's house. George got to his feet as she passed, and Clay was sure he meant to kill her as he had the old man. He winced in anticipation and saw Tom reaching for Alice to turn her away. But George only followed the woman, disappearing around the corner of the house behind her. Alice turned and hurried toward the kitchen door.
"Don't let them see you,"
Tom called in a low, urgent voice, and went after her.
"Don't worry,"
she said. Clay followed, worrying for all of them. They reached the dining room door in time to watch the woman in her filthy pantsuit and George in his even filthier coverall pass beyond the dining room window, their bodies broken into segments by Venetian blinds which had been dropped but not closed. Neither of them glanced toward the house, and now George was so close behind the woman that he could have bitten the nape of her neck. Alice, followed by Tom and Clay, moved up the hall to Tom's little office. Here the blinds were closed, but Clay saw the projected shadows of the two outside pass swiftly across them. Alice went on up the hall, toward where the door to the enclosed porch stood open. The comforter lay half on and half off the couch as Clay had left it. The porch was flooded with brilliant morning sunshine. It seemed to burn on the boards.
"Alice, be careful," Clay said. "Be—"
But she had stopped. She was just looking. Then Tom was standing beside her, almost exactly the same height. Seen that way, they could have been brother and sister. Neither of them took any pains at all to avoid being seen.
"Holy fucking shit," Tom said.
He sounded as if the wind had been knocked out of him. Beside him, Alice began to cry. It was the sort of out-of-breath weeping a tired child might make, one who was becoming used to punishment. Clay caught up. The woman in the pantsuit was cutting across Tom's lawn. George was still behind her, matching her stride for stride. They were almost in lockstep. That broke a little bit at the curb when George swung out to her left, becoming her wingman instead of her back door. Salem Street was full of crazy people. Clay's first assessment was that there might be 1,000 or more. Then the observer part of him took over, the cold-hearted artist's eye, and he realized that was a wild overestimate, prompted by surprise at seeing anyone at all on what he had expected would be an empty street, and shock at realizing they were all them. There was no mistaking the vacant faces, the eyes that seemed to look beyond everything, the dirty, bloody, disheveled clothing, in several cases no clothing at all, the occasional cawing cry or jerky gesture. There was the man dressed only in tighty-whitey undershorts and a polo shirt, who seemed to be saluting repeatedly, the heavyset woman whose lower lip was split and hung in two beefy flaps, revealing all of her lower teeth, the tall teenage boy in blue jeans shorts who walked up the center of Salem Street, carrying what looked like a blood-caked tire iron in one hand, an Indian or Pakistani gentleman who passed Tom's house wriggling his jaw from side to side and simultaneously chattering his teeth. A boy, dear God, a boy Johnny's age, who walked with absolutely no sign of pain, although one arm was flapping below the knob of his dislocated shoulder. A pretty young woman in a short skirt and a shell top who appeared to be eating from the red stomach of a crow. Some moaned, some made vocal noises that might once have been words, and all were moving east. Clay had no idea if they were being drawn by the braying alarm or the smell of food, but they were all walking in the direction of Malden Center.
"Christ, it's zombie heaven," Tom said.
Clay didn't bother answering. The people out there weren't exactly zombies, but Tom was pretty close, just the same. If any of them looks over here, sees us, and decides to come after us, we're done. We won't have a hope in hell. Not even if we barricade ourselves in the cellar. And getting those guns across the street? You can forget that. The idea that his wife and son might be, very likely were, having to deal with creatures such as these filled him with dread. But this was no comic book, and he was no hero. He was helpless. The three of them might be safe in the house, but as far as the immediate future was concerned, it didn't look like he and Tom and Alice were going anywhere. Chapter 14.
They're like birds, Alice said.
She wiped the tears from her cheeks with the heels of her hands.
A flock of birds.
Clay saw what she meant at once and gave her an impulsive hug. She had put her finger on something that had first struck him as he'd watched George the mechanic follow the woman instead of killing her, as he had the old man. The two of them clearly vacant in the upper story, yet seeming to go out front by some unspoken agreement.
I don't get it, Tom said.
You must have missed March of the Penguins, Alice said.
Actually, I did, Tom said. When I want to see someone waddle in a tuxedo, I go to a French restaurant. But haven't you ever noticed the way birds are, especially in the spring and fall? Clay asked. You must have. They'll all light in the same tree or along the same telephone wire.
Sometimes so many they make it sag, Alice said. Then they all fly at once. My dad says they must have a group leader, but Mr. Sullivan in Earth Science, back in middle school this was, told us it was a flock mind thing, like ants all going out from a hill or bees from a hive.
The flock swoops right or left, all at the same time, and the individual birds never hit each other, Clay said. Sometimes the sky's black with them and the noise is enough to drive you nuts. He paused. At least out in the country where I live. He paused again.
Tom, do you recognize any of those people?
A few. That's Mr. Potawatomi from the bakery, he said, pointing to the Indian man who was wriggling his jaw and chattering his teeth.
That pretty young woman? I believe she works in the bank. And do you remember me mentioning Scottoni, the man who lives on the other side of the block from me?
Clay nodded. Tom, now very pale, pointed to a visibly pregnant woman dressed only in a food-stained smock that came down to her upper thighs. Blonde hair hung against her pimply cheeks, and a stud gleamed in her nose.
That's his daughter-in-law, he said. Judy. She has gone out of her way to be kind to me.
He added in a dry, matter-of-fact tone,
This breaks my heart.
From the direction of the town center there came a loud gunshot. Alice cried out, but this time Tom didn't have to cover her mouth. She did it herself. None of the people in the street glanced over, in any case. Nor did the report, Clay thought it had been a shotgun, seem to disturb them. They just kept walking, no faster and no slower. Clay waited for another shot. Instead there was a scream, very brief, there and gone, as if cut off. The three standing in the shadows just beyond the porch went on watching, not talking. All of the people who passed were going east, and although they did not precisely walk in formation, there was an unmistakable order about them. For Clay it was best expressed not in his view of the phone crazies themselves, who often limped and sometimes shambled, who gibbered and made odd gestures, but in the silent, ordered passage of their shadows on the pavement. They made him think of World War II newsreel footage he'd seen, where wave after wave of bombers flew across the sky. He counted 250 before giving up. Men, women, teenagers. Quite a few children Johnny's age, too. Far more children than old people, although he saw only a few kids younger than 10. He didn't like to think of what must have happened to the little guys and gals who'd had no one to take care of them when the pulse occurred. Or the little guys and gals who'd been in the care of people with cell phones. As for the vacant-eyed children he could see, Clay wondered how many now passing before him had pestered their parents for cell phones with special ringtones last year, as Johnny had.
One mind, Tom said presently. Do you really believe that?
I sort of do, Alice said.
Because, like, what mind do they have on their own?
She's right, Clay said. The migration, Once you'd seen it that way, it was hard to think of it as anything else. Thinned, but didn't stop, even after half an hour. Three men would pass, walking abreast, one in a bowling shirt, one in the remains of a suit, one with his lower face mostly obliterated in a cake of dried gore, and then two men and a woman walking in a half-assed conga line, then a middle-aged woman who looked like a librarian, if you ignored one bare breast wagging in the wind, that was, walking in tandem with a half-grown, gawky girl who might have been a library aide. There would be a pause, and then a dozen more would come, seeming almost to form a kind of hollow square, like a fighting unit from the Napoleonic Wars. And in the distance, Clay began to hear warlike sounds, a sporadic rattle of rifle or pistol fire, and once, and close, maybe from neighboring Medford or right here in Malden, the long, ripping roar of a large-caliber automatic weapon. Also, more screams. Most were distant, but Clay was pretty sure that was what they were. There were still other sane people around these parts, plenty of them, and some had managed to get their hands on guns. Those people were very likely having themselves a phoner shoot. Others, however, had not been lucky enough to have been indoors when the sun came up and the crazies came out. He thought of George the mechanic gripping the old man's head in his orange hands, the twist, the snap, the little reading glasses flying into the beats where they would stay. And stay, and stay.
"I think I want to go into the living room and sit down," Alice said. "I don't want to look at them anymore. Listen, either. It makes me sick."
"Sure," Clay said. "Tom, why don't you..."
"No,"
Tom said. "You go. I'll stay here and watch for a while. I think one of us ought to watch, don't you?" Clay nodded. He did.
"Then, in an hour or so, you can spell me? Turn and turn about?"
"Okay. Done." As they started back down the hall, Clay with his arm around Alice's shoulders, Tom said,
"One thing."
They looked back at him.
"I think we all ought to try and get as much rest as possible today. If we're still planning on going north, that is."
Clay looked at him closely to make sure Tom was still in his right mind. He appeared to be, but...
"Have you been seeing what's going on out there?" he asked. "Hearing the shooting? The..."
He didn't want to say the screams with Alice there, although God knew it was a little late to be trying to protect her remaining sensibilities.
"The yelling?"
"Of course," Tom said. "But the Nutters went inside last night, didn't they?"
For a moment, neither Clay nor Alice moved. Then Alice began to pat her hands together in soft, almost silent applause. And Clay began to smile. The smile felt stiff and unfamiliar on his face, and the hope that went with it was almost painful.
"Tom, you might just be a genius," he said.
Tom did not return the smile.
"Don't count on it," he said. "I never broke 1,000 on the SATs.
Chapter 15. Clearly feeling better, and that had to be a good thing, Clay reckoned, Alice went upstairs to poke around in Tom's clothes for daywear. Clay sat on the couch, thinking about Sharon and Johnny, trying to decide what they would have done and where they would have gone, always supposing they'd been fortunate enough to get together. He fell into a doze and saw them clearly at Kent Pond Elementary, Sharon's school. They were barricaded in the gym with 2 or 3 dozen others, eating sandwiches from the cafeteria and drinking those little cartons of milk. Alice roused him, calling from upstairs. He looked at his wristwatch and saw he'd been sleeping on the couch for almost 20 minutes. He drooled on his chin.
"Alice?"
He went to the foot of the stairs.
"Everything okay?"
Tom, he saw, was also looking.
"Yes, but can you come for a second?"
"Sure." He looked at Tom, shrugged, then went upstairs. Alice was in a guest bedroom that looked like it hadn't seen many guests, although the 2 pillows suggested that Tom had spent most of the night here with her, and the rumpled look of the bedclothes further suggested very bad rest. She had found a pair of khakis that almost fit, and a sweatshirt with Kenobi Lake Park written across the front below the outline of a roller coaster. On the floor was the sort of large, portable sound system that Clay and his friends had once lusted after, the way Johnny G. had lusted after that red cell phone. Clay and his friends had called such systems ghetto blasters, or boom boxes.
"It was in the closet, and the batteries look fresh,"
she said. I thought of turning it on and looking for a radio station, but then I was afraid.
He looked at the ghetto blaster sitting there on the guest room's nice hardwood floor, and he was afraid too. It could have been a loaded gun. But he felt an urge to reach out and turn the selector knob, now pointed at CD, to FM. He imagined Alice had felt the same urge, and that was why she'd called him. The urge to touch a loaded gun would have been no different.
My sister gave me that 2 birthdays ago, Tom said from the doorway, and they both jumped. I loaded it up with batteries last July and took it to the beach. When I was a kid, we all used to go to the beach and listen to our radios, although I never had one that big.
Me either, Clay said, but I wanted one.
I took it up to Hampton Beach in New Hampshire with a bunch of Van Halen and Madonna CDs, but it wasn't the same, not even close. I haven't used it since. I imagine all the stations are off the air, don't you?
I bet some of them are still on, Alice said. She was biting at her lower lip. Clay thought if she didn't stop soon, it would begin to bleed.
The ones my friends call the Robo-80s stations? They have friendly names like Bob and Frank, but they all come from some giant radio computer in Colorado and then get beamed down by satellite. At least that's what my friends say. And
she licked at the place she had been biting. It was shiny with blood just under the surface.
And that's the same way cell phone signals get routed, isn't it? By satellite?
I don't know, Tom said. I guess the long-distance ones might, and the transatlantic ones for sure. And I suppose the right genius could hack the wrong satellite signal into all those microwave towers you see, the ones that boost the signals along.
Clay knew the towers he was talking about, steel skeletons with dishes stuck all over them like gray suckers. They had popped up everywhere over the last 10 years.
Tom said, if we could pick up a local station, we might be able to get news, some idea about what to do, where to go.
Yes, but what if it's on the radio, too? Alice said. That's what I'm saying. What if you tune into whatever my...
She licked her lips again, then resumed nibbling.
My mother heard. And my dad? Him, too. Oh, yes, he had a brand new cell phone. All the bells and whistles. Video auto-dial internet connection. He'd love that puppy.
She gave a laugh that was both hysterical and rueful, a dizzy combination.
What if you tune into whatever they heard? My folks and them out there. Do you want to risk that?
At first Tom said nothing. Then he said cautiously, as if testing the idea.
One of us could risk it. The other two could leave and wait until...
No, Clay said.
Please no,
Alice said. She was almost crying again.
I want you both. I need you both.
They stood around the radio looking at it. Clay found himself thinking of science fiction novels he'd read as a teenager, sometimes at the beach listening to Nirvana instead of Van Halen on the radio. In more than a few of them, the world ended, and then the heroes built it back up again. Not without struggles and setbacks, but yes, they used the tools and the technology, and they built it back up again. He couldn't remember any where the heroes just stood around in a bedroom looking at a radio.
Sooner or later, someone is going to pick up a tool or turn on a radio, he thought, because someone will have to.
Yes, but not this morning.
Feeling like a traitor to something larger than he could understand, he picked up Tom's ghetto blaster, put it back in the closet, and closed the door.
Chapter 16. An hour or so later, the orderly migration to the east began to collapse. Clay was on watch. Alice was in the kitchen, eating one of the sandwiches they'd brought out of Boston. She said they had to finish the sandwiches before they ate any of the canned stuff in Tom's closet-sized pantry, because none of them knew when they'd get fresh meat again. And Tom was sleeping in the living room, on the couch. Clay could hear him snoring contentedly away. He noticed a few people wandering against the general easterly flow, then sensed a kind of slackening in the order out there in Salem Street, something so subtle that his brain registered what his eye saw only as an intuition. At first he dismissed it as a falsity caused by the few wanderers, even more deranged than the rest, who were heading west instead of east, and then he looked down at the shadows. The neat herringbone patterns he had observed earlier had begun to distort, and soon they weren't patterns at all.
More people were now heading west, and some of them were gnawing on food that had been liberated from a grocery store, probably the Safeway Tom had mentioned. Mr. Scottoni's daughter-in-law, Judy, was carrying a gigantic tub of melting chocolate ice cream, which had covered the front of her smock and coated her from knees to nose stud. Her chocolate-lathered face made her look like Mrs. Bones in a minstrel show. And any vegetarian beliefs Mr. Potawatomi might have once held were gone now. He strolled along noshing from a great double handful of raw hamburger meat. A fat man in a dirty suit had what looked like a partially defrosted leg of lamb, and when Judy Scottoni tried to take it from him, the fat man hit her a vicious clip in the center of the forehead with it. She fell as silently as a pole-axed steer, pregnant belly first, on top of her mostly crushed tub of Breyer's chocolate. There was a great deal of milling now, and a good deal of violence to go with it, but no return to the all-out viciousness of the afternoon before, not here in any case. In Malden Center, the alarm, tired-sounding to begin with, had long since run down. In the distance, gunfire continued to pop sporadically, but there had been nothing close since that single shotgun blast from the center of town. Clay watched to see if any of the crazies would try breaking into any of the houses, but although they occasionally walked on the lawns, they showed no signs of graduating from trespass to burglary. What they did mostly was wander around, occasionally trying to grab one another's food, sometimes fighting or biting one another. Three or four, the Scottoni woman for one, lay in the street, either dead or unconscious. Most of those who had passed Tom's house earlier were still in the town square, Clay guessed, having a street dance or maybe the first annual Malden Raw Meat Festival, and thank God for that.